Exegeting a Miracle Account by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract of the talk. An examination of the genre miracle story in the Gospels. How miracles function in the ministry of Jesus. The miracles are listed together with a quick tour of a few of them. We can define the genre miracle story as a narrative focusing on a miracle as its main feature. So this makes the genre miracle story a subgenre of narrative. So in interpreting a miracle story, we use, first of all, the features of narrative analysis. That is, we're looking for characters, we're looking for their actions, we're looking for the scenes, and we're looking for the plot, and that sort of thing. Recall that Leland Ryken, in his book on the very genres of the New Testament, includes the category of miracle story under the category of narrative. That's on page 40, I believe, of his Words of Life. The usual features of this genre, besides the usual narrative features, are, first of all, that a problem is narrated. Then a request for help is made to the healer, and in the Gospels, this is Jesus. In the Acts, this would be various apostles. And in miracle stories from outside, the biblical material would be some kind of healer. The actions of the miracle worker are described. Multnomah suggested these are quite reserved in the Gospels. And then the results are noted, and these results may take various forms. Primarily, of course, the healing or deliverance or whatever the miracle involves in solving the problem. If it's a demon possession, the response of the demon is sometimes mentioned, and rather typically the response of the spectators and such, or the person being healed, are narrated as well. Now, we're not going to find all of these in each miracle, but those are the things to be on the lookout for. If we ask ourselves how miracle stories function in the Gospels, one of the primary purposes, obviously, is to display the person of Jesus through his actions and his power. Think, for instance, of John's remark at the end of his Gospel, John 20, verses 30 and 31, where he says, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So they display the person of Jesus through his actions and power. And then back earlier in the Gospel, in John chapter 5, 30, verse 36, Jesus himself says, I have a testimony weightier than that of John, weightier than that of John the Baptist, for the very work that the Father has given me to finish and which I'm doing testifies that the Father has sent me. So the suggestion here that the works he's doing, and that certainly includes his miracles, testify that it is God the Father who has sent him. So they display the person of Jesus through his action and power. They also picture God's activity in redemption. So miracles typically have a redemptive function. They obviously here and there in the Bible and will, in connection with Jesus' second coming, have a judgmental function as well. But typically in the Gospels, Jesus' first coming, they picture God's activity in redemption. Sometimes these miracles point forward to the end of the age. That is, they are kind of a dress rehearsal or a small sample of what Jesus is going to do when he comes back again. This is particularly true of the resurrection, since he's going to raise everyone from the dead at the end, but also too of the healings. Jesus is going to heal all those who are his, at least, at the end of the age, so healings would fall in that category as well. Sometimes the miracles point backward to creation. They look at things that God has done in creation, and they do them again on a small scale. Think of the turning of the water into wine. That's something which God does every year in nature, and here Jesus does it rather suddenly, and actually a fair amount of wine, though small compared to the amount of wine that would be produced all over the earth. So that's a suggestion for the function of miracles in the Gospel. They display the person of Jesus. They picture God's activity in redemption. Sometimes they point forward to the end of the age. Sometimes they point backward to creation. And in any case, they are pointing beyond themselves to validate the person who's doing the miracle and point to him as a messenger from God. Well, let's look, first of all, we're going to categorize the miracles, the Gospels, into three big categories: healings, nature miracles, and resurrections, and putting then demonic possession, etc., and deliverance from that under healings that could have been put in a separate category. And so a kind of a quick list without references of various healings in the Gospels. We have the healing of the man with leprosy. We have the healing of the centurion's servant, of Peter's mother-in-law, of the Gadarene or Gerasene demoniacs, of the paralyzed man, of the woman with the bleeding, of two blind men, of the mute who is possessed by demon, of the fellow with the shriveled hand, of the blind mute who is possessed, of the Canaanite's daughter, of the boy with the demon, of the deaf mute, of the man possessed in the synagogue, of the blind man at Bethsaida, of the crippled woman, of the man with dropsy, of the 10 lepers, of the high priest's servant, whose ear had been cut off, you remember, the official's son, the sick man at Bethesda. And it looks like, with some uncertainty on whether we've identified as one event, one that's actually two, or combined, divided two events that are actually reports of one, it looks like we've got around 22 healings narrated in the Gospels. A sample, the healing of the Gadarene demoniac, found in Mark 5, 1-20, and its parallels. The problem is sketched for us in verses 2-5. Let me find the passage here for you. Here at the NIV. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes, and then the problem, verses 2-5, when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came to him from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. So the problem is a man possessed by spirit, and no one could subdue him anymore. They had apparently had some success earlier on, but he kept breaking the equipment, and dangerous enough and such, they just quit. And so he now, they left him alone because he lives off in the tombs by himself. He's shouting. That must be aggravating, I think, to the people in the area. And he's hurting himself. You might wonder why nobody had killed him yet, and there might be a number of reasons for that, but at least one of them might be a fear that if you kill the demonized person, the demons would move into you. Request. Well, we don't know for sure whether there's a request in this case, but let me read 6 and 7 to you. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of God Most High? Swear to God that you won't torture me." Has the demoniac run to Jesus for healing? Or is the demoniac running to Jesus because the demons, not realizing who Jesus is initially, are hoping to attack these guys who have just come on shore? And so he's doing something of that sort. We don't know, and that's a problem with demon possessions, and particularly with this particular incident here in Mark 5 and its parallels, is we're not always sure whether it's the demoniac acting or whether it's the demons through him, running him, so to speak, acting him, so to speak. So we could run this in either possibility. It might be that as he came ashore, the demons inside the man recognized who it was, and the man, hearing who it was, decides to run to Jesus and see if he can get help, and he's pretty close before the demons realize what's going on and react. Or it may be that the demons don't realize who Jesus is initially and come charging down and intending to start beating on this Jesus and his disciples and then see who he is, and suddenly they are caught up very quickly and very fearful. So I don't know if there's a request there or not, but it's possible. The action is seen in verses 8-13. Let me read that quickly for you. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of God, Most High? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus was saying to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into him." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Now that's 8 through 13. We see here action. The demons are resisting Jesus' commands. He asks them the name, and then that reveals the size of the problem. This is not just one demon. This is, in fact, a large number of demons. We're legion, they say, refer to a large military unit of several thousand men in the Roman army, etc. And then the demons seek to negotiate with him, and Jesus, if you like, allows himself to be persuaded to let them to go into the pigs. What are the results? The results are sketched for us in 13 through 20. He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 number, rushed down the steep slope into the bank and were drowned, in the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and the countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting in the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell unto the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. So the results, well, the demons go out of the demoniac. They go into the pigs. The pigs drown in the lake. The pig keepers run to report. They're obviously not their own pigs, though they might include some of them. And so they're running to try and establish some kind of a decent alibi here and tell people what's going on that perhaps do own the pigs. Mm-hmm. The people come, and they are astonished at the change in the demoniac. They are fearful, seeing the power that Jesus has shown here. And they ask Jesus to leave. And this may represent, as many have suggested, just a desire to protect themselves financially. May just represent the fear of Jesus' supernatural power. Not sure. It's not explained to us in detail. Mm. Well, Jesus won't let the demoniac, the former demoniac, go with him, but in fact sends him back to tell others, and we're told that he tells in the Decapolis, this legion of a league of 10 cities, what has been done, and interestingly sets up then the situation for an event a couple chapters later in Mark, where Jesus will feed the 4,000 over in the Decapolis area. So in a sense, Jesus sends his fellow out, and the fellow becomes kind of Jesus' advance man going into this other area. So, significance of this. What does this tell us about the person of Jesus? Well, Jesus is one who is able to subdue demons by thousands over against the various exorcists that they had, who had to use a lot of mumbo-jumbo, which Jesus doesn't use, and who perhaps would have more trouble the more demons there are. Jesus is able to subdue demons by thousands. The demons are afraid of him, clearly. Jesus has compassion for this demoniac, and apparently is aware that demons could hurt the guy in some way if he is not careful, if you like. So we have a number of mysteries about Jesus' person here, and I won't go into all of those. Each of these different incidents in the Gospels reveal a little bit about Jesus' person, and you need the whole set and connected with his resurrection and his claims, etc., to begin to put together the whole picture of Jesus. Jesus here lets people turn him down. He does that elsewhere in his ministry. He doesn't run after the rich young ruler. He lets him walk away when the rich young ruler decides that the price is too high to follow Jesus. Well, here the people are afraid of him. They perhaps have been hurt financially, don't know. And so he lets them turn him down, though he will in some sense pursue them further on. It gives us some hints perhaps on how we should behave in our evangelistic work as well. Don't come on too strong, but try and help people see the need and give them room to respond. We see some picture here of redemption as well. We see God's redemption in rescuing the demoniac from the power of these satanic beings. We see God's redemptive and judgmental power in driving out Satan's forces. We don't see force applied here quite the way we do in some of the other demonic ones, but the demons are clearly fearful of Jesus, and yet he allows them to go into the pigs. We don't know all the ins and outs of that. Some commentators suggested that these are very unkosher Jews to be raising pigs, etc., but we don't even know that they're Jews. They're across the Sea of Galilee, an area that would be largely Gentile, not totally Gentile, etc. So we do see something perhaps of God's judgment. God has a right to take away anything we own at any time. We've accumulated enough sins to deserve that. So here he allows the destruction of this herd of pigs. He drives out Satan's forces. Well, that's a quick tour of that. There are lots of interesting things in that particular incident. And the various gospel accounts of the different miracles will vary in the amount of detail they have and amount of puzzling features and that sort of thing. But it's good to be looking at what do they tell us about Jesus? What do they tell us about his power, his personality, his strategy, that sort of thing? Now, what do they tell us about God's redemptive program and things of that sort? I didn't have here on our PowerPoint talk, but does it look back to creation? Perhaps only in thinking about the fall and the fact that we have now fallen under the control of satanic forces. Does it look forward to the eschaton? Well, that's going to be the time when Satan is finally driven out, finally judged, and we will no longer have to struggle with that. So there are hints of that sort of thing in just the whole context of the picture, seeing how it fits into salvation history. Let's move on to nature miracles in the Gospels. There are not so many of those. There's Jesus calming the storm, his feeding of the 5,000, his walking on water, his feeding of the 4,000, his having Peter go out and find this coin of just the right size in the fish's mouth to pay both Peter and Jesus temple tax. The miracle of the fig tree withering, the transfiguration of Jesus, the miraculous catch of fish, both the one at the beginning and the one at the end of Jesus' ministry, the turning of the water into wine, the catch of fish at Jesus' end of his ministry. Somewhere around 10 nature miracles are narrated in the gospel. There might have been more, but that many at least, if we are right on identifying and dividing out the ones that are different, identifying the accounts that are different accounts of the same event. Sample of a nature miracle, the calming of the storm in Mark 4, 35 to 41 in parallels. Have a look at that. That day when evening came, he, Jesus, said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." So the problem, the boat is about to go under in a storm. They're out on the Sea of Galilee, which is subject occasionally to pretty fierce storms. This one has got the seasoned fishermen in the boat, which about half of Jesus' disciples are scared. Jesus, however, isn't scared. He's asleep back in the boat. You wonder how you can sleep in a boat with water sloshing over you, etc. And I think that itself is going to be a significant thing in the person of Jesus in this particular thing. We'll come back to that by and by. request. The disciples are a little impolite, you might say, and I think it's a picture of their being afraid in this whole thing. Don't you care that we're about to drown, if you like? They could have said, Jesus, wake up. We can't handle this, or something of that sort, and that would not have been perhaps a showing of lack of faith. But Jesus must suggest what they did was a lack of faith in some sense. Action. Jesus shouts, probably. The NIV here has a quotation, exclamation points after quiet and be still. Jesus shouts at the wind and the waves. Others suggested he whispered or something, but the disciples could hear him and see what he did, so suggest he's shouting at the wind and the waves. The results, immediate calm, both the wind and the waves. Both of those are rather striking. That a wind would stop immediately is pretty surprising. One might perhaps say, well, it was just a fluke. Jesus happened to say it just at the time when it was going to stop. But if you know anything about fluid mechanics, you would realize that when the wind stops, which is what sloshes the waves around, the waves don't stop until they have gotten rid of all of the energy that's been built up in them. So the waves would slosh around for another half an hour or so. So the fact that the waves stop immediately suggests we are looking at something quite miraculous here. The reaction of the disciples is pretty striking. Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. What's going on here? Well, we see something about the person of Jesus. It's interesting to look into Psalm 107. Let me find it here for you. Where we have a picture of God rescuing people from various circumstances. And in verse 23 and following, others went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants in the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunken men. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to their desired haven. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men. Let them exalt him in the assembly of the people and praise him in the council of elders. The interesting thing here is that Psalm 107 has God doing exactly what Jesus does here. And I think that's telling us something very strongly, that Jesus is indeed the one who, like God the Father, can stop the wind and the waves to rescue his people, etc. So it's got something striking there. I don't have it again in my PowerPoint, but there's something striking about Jesus' faith here as well. Jesus is not just God, he's also man. He's not just uncreated God, he is also a created human, the only being in the universe that is both created and uncreated. And we see in him a powerful example of the kind of faith we're supposed to have. He's not afraid when the sea has risen up like this and is threatening to kill him, because he knows that God has got everything under control. No matter what Satan is doing, God has got everything under control, and that he can trust God with his life. And so can we. And that's what we need to work on. And so he rebukes the disciples because they, in fact, break down in this and become, what shall we say, terrified. They lose control. Besides the purpose of a person of Jesus, we also see something about redemption here. We see rescue from danger. And that's part of what redemption is. Redemption is rescue. And here, the disciples are being rescued from danger that threatens to kill them. Is this particular event pointing forward or backward? Well, you could argue it's looking back at creation. It's looking at the waves and stuff, perhaps even looking at the dangerous features of creation, which some suggest come into existence after the fall. Others might suggest become dangerous after the fall. We're not going to solve that problem here. Is it looking forward to the new heavens and new earth? Well, there's the intriguing remark in Revelation that there'll be no sea. And so perhaps we see something of that. perhaps some idea of the sea with its waves as a picture of rebellion and chaos and that sort of thing. There's perhaps hints of that in the Old Testament, and so perhaps there's something of that sort looking forward to here. But certainly we'll be rescued from danger, finally, at the end of the age, and perhaps it's doing something of that sort. One of the striking features of this one, though, is this looking at the person of Jesus in regard to his faith, and suggesting, if the Son of God, who could call down miracles at any time and that sort of thing, could trust in his Father, why can't we trust in his Father, etc., and our Father? We moved into our third category in the Gospels. We've been looking at the healing miracles and the nature miracles, and then the resurrection miracles, if you like. There's the resurrection of Jairus' daughter, and the resurrection of the son of the widow of Nain, and the resurrection of Lazarus, and then, I put parenthesis, there's the resurrection of Jesus, okay, which Jesus himself accomplishes, as well as the Father accomplishing it and the Spirit accomplishing it. I think you'd find passages that testify to all three of those causalities, if you like, in connection with Jesus' resurrection. So we have four resurrections narrated for us in the Gospels. Let's look at the widow's son. This is found in Luke chapter 7, 11 through 17. Soon afterward, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went along with him. As he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the town was with her. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, "Don't cry." Then he went up and touched the coffin, and those carrying it stood still. He said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up, began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. They were all filled with awe and praised God. "A great prophet has appeared among us," they said. "God has come to help his people." This news about Jesus spread throughout Judea and the surrounding country. And that's the passage narration of it. The problem, the only son of a widow has died. So her own grief, her husband has died. Don't know whether any other children had died earlier. Now the last son that has left has died. She's going to be left destitute financially and that sort of thing anyway. There's no explicit request. Probably the widow doesn't realize who Jesus is or is wrapped up in her grief. The crowd with the widow probably doesn't recognize yet who Jesus is, and so he just comes up. So there's no explicit request in this particular one. There are several of the miracle accounts in the Gospels like that. Actions. Jesus comforts the widow and touches the coffin or bier, whatever it is, that they're carrying, and then Jesus speaks to the dead man. Results, the dead man comes back to life. Results, the people are filled with awe, and they praise God. They don't understand everything who Jesus is yet, but they understand at least that a great prophet has appeared among us. This is not just a talker. This is somebody that has miraculous powers. And they realize that this is God who has come to help his people, that this is not, they're not like the Pharisees and the others, perhaps, who are his opponents, who are arguing, well, this is really being done by demonic power. They praise God. What does it say about the person Jesus? He's able to raise the dead. You say, okay, but that's not unique. Elijah, Elisha raised the dead, etc. And we'll see Peter and Paul will raise the dead in the book of Acts. Yes, that's true. There's a contrast, however, here with the Old Testament prophets regarding the method. Elijah spreads himself out on the widow's son and breathes into his mouth, etc. Elisha does something similar. The prayer that they offer and things of that sort. No particular indication here that Jesus prayed. He rather gave the command, young man, get up, etc. This is one of the striking things that you see that tells us about the person of Jesus when we compare the miracles of Jesus with the miracles of Moses or Elijah or Elisha in the Old Testament, that their connection is more indirect with the miracles, and Jesus is more direct. It's saying something about Jesus' person, I think. Redemption is seen here? Well, yes, of course. Jesus has saved this fellow from death, and not like he did with the disciples in the boat, saved them from experiencing death. Here Jesus has raised this person out of the captivity to death, if you like. Obviously, it looks forward to that resurrection that will take place at the last day. Reminds us that Jesus will one day bring everyone to life. Some to the eternal life, but some will be judged and face the second death. Looks backward too. I don't think that made it on my PowerPoint here, but looks back at that curse of death coming upon mankind when Adam and Eve rebelled against God and went their own way. Well, that's the end of our quick tour here of thinking about how one is to exegete or interpret miracles. My suggestion here is that we try to see what the gospel writer is teaching us about Jesus, about redemption, etc., as he narrates each miracle.